Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome back to part two of the New Horror Express top 10 horror films of 2018. Well, it's the mixture of three different lists. My own list, Ron's list, and Storm's list. We've put them all together, and that's what we're talking about. We have reached number five on both Storm and I's lists, which was Ghost Stories, which came out in April. It technically made its debut in 2017 because it debuted at the London Film Festival in 2017, but general audiences saw it when it came out for its general release in April of 2018. So I'll let you go first, Storm, and I really love this movie. You tell us all why you really enjoyed this movie too.
Ghost Stories for me was the perfect British horror film, and I assume, I don't actually know who the director was. Was it a British director?
It was co-directed by the lead star, Andy Nyman, and Jeremy Dyson, who is one of the League of Gentlemen, but he just writes the League of Gentlemen with the League of Gentlemen. He's not one of... He doesn't generally appear on screen, although he did appear on screen in the League of Gentlemen movie that they did.
Okay. Well, to me, Ghost Stories was the perfect example of how British people deal with fear, which is similar to the way that British people deal with sex. And they will, obviously, it makes them very uncomfortable, and they will somehow make it either extremely surreal or comic.
Yes.
In a very special way that only British people can do. Mm-hmm. And I think that Ghost Stories had that in bucket loads.
Yeah.
I watched it, I felt gleeful because it was just filling me with this, Britain, you know, do you get that at all?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, like it is a very British movie. To the extent that I'm like, I wonder, you know, how it played internationally. I mean, I have actually seen good reviews for it on some American sites, but it is very much that kind of classic British film, and it is kind of partly paying tribute to those kind of British anthology, particularly the Amicus anthology movies of the 1970s. But yeah, I mean, like you say, the way it deals with kind of fear and is done in a very typically British way. I think what I liked about it as well, of like, it was just a good mixture of things, of like, it had a good kind of popcorn element, of like good jump scares. I think it had some very good jump scares, but also dealt with quite serious things, and it was also quite a melancholic film about, you know, bullying and childhood trauma and kind of standing by, you know, when you know you shouldn't. And, you know, I had all these different elements, and I think for that, for me, was what made it really good. And as well as, I also want to say, I thought pretty much all the acting was really good. And the thing that most surprised me about the acting was Paul Whitehouse playing against type in a very kind of distraught and a serious role, where he's more known for his kind of comedy stuff and doing like the Fast Show and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I think that was a big surprise for me. But and the kind of narrative trickery of it and the way it kind of goes totally mental at the end. I had great fun with it.
Yeah, I think that's it. It comes down to fun. I mean, it didn't at any point feel particularly clever. I had a lot of fun with the jump scares and with just how freaking brilliant it is. And the stories all weave together very well, but
yeah.
At no point was I thinking, wow, this is something fresh and original. And yeah, no. But I love it so much for what it is.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. Yeah, I mean, like, I think, yeah, it's not clever in this terms of like it's, yeah, it's not something original. I think it's quite clever the way the stories kind of the way the stories are weaved together. And Andy Nyman, the actor in it who plays the lead character and was co-director and co-writer with Jeremy Dyson, he also created some of the tricks for Derren Brown and stuff. Because he's a mentalist himself, and there is that kind of element of, particularly towards the end, of that kind of narrative sleight of hand of, you know, and the, you know, the kind of poster tagline of the mind sees what it sees kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of played with throughout the film, so that was quite cleverly done. But yeah, it's just a very kind of British horror movie, and just did it wasn't doing anything mind-blowing or totally out of the ordinary, but it was very finely crafted, and it did all the things that it was doing very well.
Yeah, it was sculpted perfectly. It did make me jump. It made me proud to be British.
this is a patriotic part of the episode. Where the two British people talk about it.
Yeah, too damn American. I really liked it, but yeah, wouldn't make a list. Maybe it's because I'm just not British enough yet.
You've not been fully converted. Oh well. But that's good you liked it, Ron. So at least that. So all of us like it. It's just that Storm and I liked it more because apparently British is the key. the next film that appears on all our lists that does have a British director, but it isn't very British at all, is Annihilation. Now, this appeared at number 7 on both Storm and I's lists, but appeared way up at number 4 for you, Ron. So you can take the lead on it first.
Well, I have to say, a friend recommended the book to me, or the Southern Reach trilogy, a long time ago, with you know, and also in the form. But actually, no, he just recommended it as a book. And I read it, and it was one of the stranger books I've ever read, which is saying something. Reminded me a little bit of J.G. Ballard stuff, but it was just a fairly unique reading experience. So when I heard they were making a film of it, I was like, ooh, how are they going to do that? And it was just, I was really excited for this. And then when I found out that Alex Garland was directing, I was even more excited about it because he seemed like the perfect choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't disappointed. I mean, it was a little bit totally different than I wanted it to be, but it worked. Mm-hmm. And I think, if you have read the Southern Reach trilogy, you understand that it's just quite a feat to pull off what he did. And it's not a perfect film by any means, but it succeeds on many levels. And I just thoroughly enjoyed it. And the music was great. I really liked what they did with the score. They deviated from the book somewhat, but in ways that worked and made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was, for what it was very well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you read the book, Scott?
I have not. Now, the interesting thing about this is I watched the movie and I enjoyed the movie as a movie. But Alyssa, who, for listeners' benefit, is my partner and who does my theme music. So if you want to check out any of her other music, you can check it out at alyssavilpez.com. But she started watching the movie with me. And we watched about 50 minutes of it. And she had read the book, really liked the book, and just couldn't get into the film. So like we watched like the first 50 minutes, we stopped, you know, and then like months later, I went back and watched the film myself and enjoyed it. But
I'd like to talk to you about that because like I could see why as a fan of the book, and the book was as always the case, the book was better. Mm-hmm. But you know, what they did succeed with was just. It was pretty mind-blowing to get that sort of dreamlike, surreal feel that you got from the book into the film. I thought it was very impressive. And it makes more sense, too, if you have read the two books after. Mm-hmm. Contextually, it kind of adds something, I think. But, I would say, if Alyssa, if you're listening, you should give it another try because it's worth it.
I haven't read the book, so uh-huh. I was coming to it blind as well. And I think, it made my top 10, but the reason it's lower down in mine is it felt a little rushed to me, which seems to be common with Alex Garland films. Like, I had similar experience when I watched The Beach. Mm. And I feel like, for me anyway, I always feel like, just slow down. It's okay. You know, I want to take this in and I want to understand a little more. And he just races on forward. But the effects in the film blew me away. How could they not?
A monster.
Yeah.
Scary.
Yeah.
Effects,
yeah.
Sorry? Ex Machina.
Yeah.
I actually slightly preferred Ex Machina as a film. Overall, even though I did really like this film, and I thought it, I mean, like you say, some of the effects are amazing, and I think some of the images, particularly towards the end of the film, really do stick in your mind. And but I don't know, like there was Storm was saying, that there was that element of kind of like stuffing so much in. And could have paced it out better. And it's almost weird because, like, I feel like it's quite measuredly paced in the opening, and then just kind of, you know, it's like, oh yeah, and then we kind of rush through things. I did find it an interesting mix of things, though, because like it did have like the kind of what I see is like, you know, the kind of two threat, you know, like two of the kind of different strands of sci-fi, not necessarily horror, but sci-fi, because it had that kind of philosophical 2001 tinky sci-fi, and also the kind of more claustrophobic kind of alien thing. There was a lot of alien. I felt in that movie, you know, and particularly towards the end, there's like, you know, kind of Geiger-esque kind of imagery and that, just that whole kind of team survival thing, you know, there was a heavy alien influence, I felt, but those kind of two different strands of sci-fi that don't often kind of come together well, like in Prometheus.
Oh, we're gonna have to talk about this one.
Oh, it's okay, we won't get on it, Prometheus. It's too much. There was another episode where I can't remember who I was talking to. One of the other episodes, I got into Prometheus a little bit. I think it's the next episode that's coming with the founders of the Sinister Horror Company. Anyway, that's beside the point. We're getting off track.
Everybody stop mentioning Prometheus.
To be fair, that was me that time. That was anyway, where are we on the list? Back to the list. The next on the list is my number 4. Which is Revenge. I don't know, have either of you seen Revenge?
No.
I read the synopsis based on your list, Scott, and it didn't really grab me or sound like a horror film proper. So I'll be interested in talking about it.
Likewise.
So I'll shut up.
Yep. Go for it. It's all yours.
Go for it. Well, I mean, like, again, in the kind of grand lexicon of horror subgenres, rape revenge is counted as a horror subgenre. And it is not a subgenre I am particularly a fan of. I have seen a few rape revenge. I went through a period where I was watching quite a lot of video nasties of the things that were on the video nasty list.
Spit on your grave and
things like that. I mean, I do have some affection for I don't know if affection is the right word, but I do.
I wouldn't use that word in connection with this particular subgenre.
I know. I have some affection for Last House on the Left. No, it doesn't sound right. Wes Craven's debut is an interesting movie that has good things about it. Affection for it is maybe the wrong word. Anyway, that's kind of getting off track. Revenge is a very good movie. It is directed by a woman called Coralie Fargeet. Being a female director puts a little bit of a different spin on the material. I just think it's a really well done movie. The rape scene in it is done a bit better. It doesn't feel as gratuitous or exploitative as 99% of those movies. The revenge is actually pretty fun. It's all kind of done in a very heightened reality. The way it's filmed, it's filmed in a very stylized way. It's got these kind of eye-scorching, psychotronic colors coming at you. It's kind of almost like a kind of superhero origin tale where she's like a kind of avenging angel. It's very fast paced. There's some very well done gore. French people are just very good at gore effects. I've seen a lot of French movies that have the nastiest, just the nastiest bone crunching gore. I don't know what it is to do with the French horror industry, but God damn, do they know how to make things just look really gruesome and quite realistic. So many of those films.
Can I ask, I haven't seen this one, but I have seen quite a few sort of rape revenge movies. Yeah. And there's always a point in the film where I begin to feel physically sick, not because of gore, but just because of the subject matter. And I will sit through it if the movie's good enough. But did you have that feeling in your stomach at any point?
The early scenes are uncomfortable. I mean, deliberately made uncomfortable. What I will say, what I felt differentiated it, but and I have to say, like, I mean, some critics have kind of claimed it as a, you know, being revolutionary. It's not quite as revolutionary or subversive as some maybe have claimed. But I will say, while I felt uncomfortable, there was not the same griminess that I felt like when watching most other rape revenge movies, of like
word,
you know, that kind of just kind of like, oh man, I'm gonna need to shower after this, you know. Yeah. There wasn't that same kind of thing to it. So while it was, you know, the filmmaker deliberately turns the screws, makes it very uncomfortable, you hate these fucking guys, they're all fucking assholes, yeah, and they're not that same thing. And I think that is a big differentiation.
What is it about the French? Because probably what I think is the best of that genre would be Irreversible, I think it was called.
Irreversible, yeah.
It was all backward. It was a shocking film. I believe that. I remember being French. And I think, and there was another one recently. Was it Victoria by what's his name, Vandenberg, the guy that did Starship Troopers and
RoboCop. L.
That's right, yeah.
Paul Verhoeven. I think there's both of those are really, I think both of those are really good films.
Is The Reversible not Italian?
I think it's French.
Is it?
Yeah. No, it's French. It's a French movie. It does star Monica Bellucci, who is Italian, but it is a French movie.
That's why I got confused.
The director is Gaspar Noé, who's actually Argentinian, but lives in France and makes films in France.
Did he not do Man Bites Dog as well?
Hmm?
Did he do Man Bites Dog?
No, that's not one of his. He had a movie this year, Climax, and he's had a few other movies. He had a movie called Enter the Void that came out like 2010, he had a movie that was just called Love. They're all kind of extreme cinema films. I was a little bit disappointed with Climax. I thought it was going to, like, when I saw it at cinemas, I thought, I kind of looked forward to it and thought, oh, this might be one that makes my list, but it didn't in the end. So there you go.
All right, well, I'm going to look up Revenge. You've convinced me it's one worth seeing.
Worth seeing.
Yep.
And the next one, both of you guys convinced me it is worth seeing. I will check out, because I am a subscriber to Shudder, but I have not seen Terrified, or to give it its original title, Atrados, an Argentinian film. You take it away on that one.
Storm made a great point on this one, which was, I wonder if it would have been as effective had it not been Argentinian, because I, for one, have never seen an Argentinian horror film before.
We were talking about how horror films definitely can add to the fear by being set in a culture that you don't know or you don't understand.
Yeah.
And this is the first time we'd seen an Argentine horror film. And of course, that got us talking about Japanese horror and so on, but we won't get onto that. But there was an element in this movie, for sure, for me, of it being a very different culture, because you would watch scenes and go, but why would they do that? And they wouldn't say that. But then I find myself going, well, perhaps they would, you know, maybe this is a cultural thing. Mm. And that makes it feel all the more alien and lonely when you watch it.
Yeah, I found all the characters very relatable, and there was some strange choice. I don't want to give too much away, because it's a pretty unique experience to see. It just kind of plops you right in the middle of it from the first scene, and doesn't explain much, and you're just sort of along for the ride, and it's quite confusing and disorienting. But some genuinely creepy stuff in there, which again, I don't want to go into too much detail, because I don't want to ruin the experience for the listeners. But yeah, it was it exceeded my expectations. I'd heard good things, and I really enjoyed it.
It
was one of those movies that really taps into childhood fears and does it perfectly, just in terms of the sort of nightmares you remember having when you were kids, that you sort of block out as an adult, and then a movie like this will come along and you're reminded of them, and something very primal in you gets a little shiver down your spine. And it did that perfectly.
There was also some scenes that were reminiscent of Paranormal Activity to me, but I'm not a fan of those films, but you know, it did it right. It was like, this is how it's done. It really played on
supposed to be done.
yeah, I mean, it was just intensely creepy from beginning to end, and that's what I'm looking for in horror films, really. And thought-provoking as well. You sort of kept on wondering what the hell just happened there, like, long after the credits roll. So yeah, recommend it.
Absolutely, check out. I will say, I think there was moments during the film that I could see where people would watch it and maybe not be quite as on board with it as I was. Just because it's a very particular type of scare. And that's good. I mean, that's what I loved about it. But I think some people would watch it and be like, why is that scary? I don't get it.
I found one of the creepier elements, the way it tried to sort of normalize, the way the characters tried to normalize what was going on. And there's unusual reactions to the horrific things going on around them, trying to make sense of them. And whenever I see people sort of do irrational reactions to ways that are played out in understandable means, it really it's an extra level of psychological horror that I respond to.
And I get a very particular fear from it being a funeral director, because you see how they're dealing with a body in this film, or dealing with something supernatural involving a cemetery or a morgue or something like that. And I guess it just hits home for me because that's where I am on an almost daily basis. Yeah. So it's a very unique kind of fear for me, but it's there.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you've definitely convinced me that it is.
Might I say, we watched this on my couch in the other room where we are now, and a Storm was squirming a few times.
It takes a lot to make me afraid.
Yeah, being a funeral director and a death doula, and having seen her share of horror films, I've rarely seen her that uncomfortable.
I mean, that's a recommendation in and of itself. I think. Absolutely. I definitely heard a lot of good things, got a lot of good reviews. I saw a lot of people listing it as one of their favorite films at Arrow's Fright Fest when that was happening. And when it came out on Shudder in October time, again, it seemed to get a lot of good feedback from horror fans and stuff. So it's definitely on my list of things to watch and catch up on.
Okay, good stuff.
Yeah. We've given each other a lot to watch in the next few weeks.
We have.
And the listeners.
Yeah, I mean, and I've got so many other things to watch as well, you know. I've got to, review, movies each week.
Oh, it's a tough life. All these great horror films.
I know. It's hard. It's a hard knock life for the life of a horror podcaster reviewer. So we'll move on to the next film we've got. All of us had it on our list at various different points. So to kind of count down, it's A Quiet Place. It was my number 3, it was Storm's number 6, and it was Ron's number 7. So, do one of you want to start in A Quiet Place?
I just want to say the reason why it was my number 7, because I really did enjoy it, and it was I thought it was a great premise, but there was some, I can't talk about what I saw as plot flaws, but I thought there was some inherent plot flaws. I mean, I thought it was... God, how do I talk about this without ruining it? You've probably all seen it, but
yeah, everyone's seen Quiet Place, right? Seen Quiet Place. Yeah,
I think of all, you know, of the films we're kind of talking about, some of them might have kind of passed people by, even some of the what I would consider some of the bigger films, even things like Ghost Stories that had quite a wide release, certainly here in the UK.
Yeah,
I don't know, I think A Quiet Place, in terms of box office, in terms of the people who have seen it, is possibly the biggest. Certainly one of the biggest on the list. Probably.
I would say The Quiet Place and Get Out have the most mainstream appeal of any horror film to come out in the last 10 years. I mean, universal appeal.
Yeah,
and that was part of my criticism, I guess, is that it was a little bit too mainstream for my taste. I mean, a lot of it worked on the performances of Emily Blunt and John Krasinski. Is that how you say
it? John Krasinski is it?
Krasinski.
Sorry, John Krasinski. Right. Yeah, it's the American office. And I guess he's Jack Reacher now, isn't he? Big time Hollywood actor, and he wrote and directed it, which is great. But
debut feature.
It was so obvious how to defeat the monsters from the beginning of the film that it kind of wrecked it for me. And then they all sort of treated it like it was some huge, you know, like, oh, that's it, you know, like all the notes scrawled on the dry erase board and all that in the background of his office. I mean, it just didn't really, all the way through, I was thinking like, well, you know, if they work on sound, of course, and then it just sort of played out till the end. And for me, that was the main criticism, because the rest of it was fantastic, and it was just a lovely film, and especially the Emily Blunt was amazing, as she always is.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it was great, but just because of that, it was a little too mainstream, and it just seemed like the reveal at the end was just too spelled out from square one. Anyway, story.
Okay, well, A Quiet Place, I unfortunately missed when it was released in the cinema. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't see it before the year was out. So Ron and I sat and watched it last week. And I knew I was going to love it. I love Emily Blunt. It had such great reviews. And I did enjoy it a great deal. I think what was problematic for me is that I watched it a few days apart from Bird Box, which had just been released on Netflix. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of similarities in the plot there. What I love, truly loved about A Quiet Place is, and I always enjoy this in a horror film, is watching a family dynamic play out and change.
So well.
And it was beautiful the way they used that as the backdrop for the horror film, and it was so well written and acted, and I felt so involved with each character. I loved it. It was a great film, and I'm so happy I managed to fit it in before the year, end of the year. But I did constantly go, okay, this was reminding me of Bird Box, and this is a lot like, what was the other one we likened it to? The Happening.
The Happening, yeah.
Yes.
The Happening?
Yeah.
Wow. Not thought about that film in a while.
Yeah, don't.
It was not.
I mean, that's all kind of, all different colors of stupid, that movie. There was a time where M. Night Shyamalan was considered he was going to be the next Spielberg. That was a famous
one. Right.
He's kind of getting kudos back now, because a lot of people like Split, which I enjoyed as well, and a lot of people are quite excited for Glass that comes out very soon.
Tell us your thoughts, Scott, on
A Quiet Place. I loved A Quiet Place. I thought it was great. To go with your point, one of your points, so the family dynamic, I thought, was one of the key strengths of focusing on that family dynamic. And the way that family dynamic shifts over the course of the movie. One of the things you mentioned, Ron, was you felt it was quite mainstream, which it was in a way, but for me, it did certain things that weren't mainstream, that seemed a bit kind of like, you know, like daring. I like the whole, like the opening scene. I mean, the opening bit. Yeah. That's a daring gambit for like a mainstream movie. Yeah. I think that's a daring gambit for most movies, to kill a kid. I mean, like, because it's the opening scene, I feel like I can spot it. To kill a kid that early on in the film, I think that's a pretty startling statement of intent. I think there was a few kind of, people have kind of, there's been a bit of a backlash on this movie as well, where people have said, well, you know, the plot's a bit silly sometimes, and there's these kind of plot flaws, and this thing wouldn't work, and that thing wouldn't work. And my kind of thing about that is, I think there's certain movies that are good enough, that have enough tension, that have enough kind of pace, and are, you know, and invest you enough that you don't think about those plot flaws until after you watch the movie. So, and I think A Quiet Place, much like something like the last film I can think about that I watched that was like that, that was like when you thought about it, kind of like, you kind of thought like, what? Was Mad Max Fury Road. And it's because everything happens at such an unbelievable pace. There's so many, there's so much going on. And in the terms of this film, it wasn't too so much to do with like the action and there's so much going on, but the tension and the involvement in this family story kind of overrides the plot flaws. And I didn't think about the kind of things that were silly about the plot until after I watched it.
You're 100% right. It was a white knuckle ride, and it completely succeeded as far as that goes. And it was a lot of fun and very moving too. I mean,
to go back to what you said there about killing the kid at the start of the film, that is a very shocking thing to happen. And I have to admit, throughout the rest of the film, I was expecting him to still be alive somehow.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, I didn't see that as death, because I was like, they couldn't possibly start with that. You know, I was like, okay, well, he's going to come back. They're going to find him in the woods, or he will have survived somehow. And also, I feel like I should say, as a woman, and I won't ruin the scene in case some people haven't seen this, but there was a particular scene where if you've been through that particular type of feminine pain, you really do cross your legs and you feel so strongly for her and you just want to scream on her behalf. And I had to hold in a scream.
I can only imagine.
I wanted to vocalize it for her. And I think that just says a lot about the strength of the film and how attached you are to the characters.
Yeah. I can only but agree on.
Yeah. I know that's one for the women, but yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So next up, on the kind of the review of this, you know, and we kind of all pooled resources and we did our lists, and then you both cheated. included a TV program. It was Ron's number two. It was Storm's number three. It's the most talked about horror TV show of the year. It's The Haunting of Hill House, which I have actually not. So Ron and Storm, take it away on The Haunting of Hill House.
Well, first off, I just want to say the fact that this is a TV show and not a film, and it still made it into the list, just shows how great this truly is.
How much you wanted to talk about
it. And how badly we needed to talk about it. It wasn't just wanted, needed to talk about this in our review of 2018 horror.
And Scott, I feel like if you haven't seen it yet, and it's like
it's like
a film in itself. It's almost a self-contained film that works as a greater whole. And it deserves to be on this list. And I think you'd agree, particularly the Bent Neck Lady episode 5, which is just terrifying. Mm. It's one of the scariest things I've ever seen. And I went in very critical of this series because I'm a huge fan. One of my all time favorite films is I think it was a 1963 film called The Haunting. Not that early.
Yeah.
Not the one with Catherine Zeta-Jones and Chris Owen. And that is a fantastic film, the old black and white ghost story. And the way they reference that without using the source material too much is very clever. And it's just perfect in so many ways, particularly that episode. I can see why a lot of people criticize the finale as being a bit schmaltzy and over sentimental.
Yeah.
But I can see that. But just watch that episode 5. I mean, it's just, it's scary as hell, and will stick with you.
And Ron and I have watched a lot of horror films together and a lot of horror TV and so on, and never have we clung to each other so much, not just in fear, but just because it was so intense emotionally as well. And I think that says a lot about it.
Yeah.
You will need someone to cling to.
You really care about all the characters in this and what happens to them and the way it plays out, which I don't want to ruin anything because it's such a unique experience. And just, man, it's just everything's important. Don't miss a detail because everything means something in the big picture of what is.
Yeah, we kept saying to each other, like I would say to Ron, did you just see that statue move? And he would be like, oh, did you see that move?
Yeah,
and there's so many little details, which I love. I know some people find them irritating, but I really love that attachment to detail.
Yeah, and I grew up on The Haunting, which scared the hell out of me when I was a kid. And then there was The Haunting of Hell House, too, which was, I think it was a 1970s film, which was pretty good on it in its own right. And this was just sort of a classic haunted house film that was updated and just immaculately rendered, and can't recommend it enough. I mean, that is my favorite genre of horror, and it was just fantastic. So if you haven't seen it already, do it.
And I've never read the book, and I think a lot of what was included in the series was put in. A lot of stuff wasn't in the book. But, you know, they did modernize it, and there was a lot of issues that people are dealing with today, you know, drug addiction and so on. And so it was very relevant and very terrifying in that way as well. And once again, coming back to my particular career choice, the character, the main character in this, runs a funeral home. So a lot of fear and attachment I have to the series comes from the way they depicted death and corpses and a funeral home and how things work there. It also, of course, annoyed me in parts, as it does with many horror films, when you watch the way that you know, a mortician will deal with a corpse or a particular situation. But all in all, a very positive experience, and I'm very excited to see what they're going to do in season two with all of the characters, especially, and the future of the funeral home.
Okay.
Are we bored you to death?
No, absolutely not. I was fascinated listening to your views on the Haunting of Hill House. I will definitely put it on my to watch list. Well, it was already on my to watch list because I've heard so much about it. It's supposed to be one of the best kind of horror TV shows that kind of there's been. So it seems like a must watch for any horror fan, and I will definitely get round to checking it out.
Amen.
Look forward to talking to you about it afterwards.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah,
absolutely. So we're nearly coming to the end of our list. We've only got two more films to talk about. Before we get to them, I think we had some kind of honorable mentions of like films that didn't make the list that, you know, there were so many, because I think 2018 has been a great year for horror movies. There was a lot of movies that I just couldn't fit into the list, but I still thought were really, really good movies. On my kind of just missed out list, there was Pie Wacket, which was your number 10, Storm. There was Knuckleball, which is a Canadian feature I saw at Dead by Dawn. Possum, which was a British feature who was directed by Matthew Holness, who's most famous for the Garth Marenghi comedy series. But it was really disturbing and depressing. I was one of the fans of the new Halloween. I thought it was one of the better entries in the franchise. There was a film that I think people should check out on Shudder, quite a small film called The Witch in the Window, and another film that I think people should check out on Shudder, which is a kind of meta horror comedy called You Might Be the Killer. And that's another one, while I'll promote myself, I talked to the director, Brett Simmons, in one of the episodes, and I've got a part two of that interview coming up in a few weeks. So that's some of the films that didn't make the list, but I would still recommend. You had some honorable mentions that you wanted to point out, Ron?
Yes, really quick. Lodger, which was flawed, but again, I'm a sucker for those haunted house sort of films. And so, resonated with me. Upgrade, which is more of a science fiction film, kind of a
Bionic Man. Yeah, I thought it was quite a fun movie.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. Ghost Stories made my honorable mention. And Possum, I thought, was incredibly effective and creepy and dark, reminiscent of Cronenberg's Spider, if you remember that one.
Yeah, I remember that one, yeah.
And Caliber was also, I really enjoyed that, but it wasn't a proper horror film, which is the only reason why I didn't make it. So, yeah, there
you go. I don't think I actually sent mine to you, but mine would be Possum and Caliber.
Well, excellent.
Same reasons with Caliber and Possum. I don't ever want to see that movie again. God damn, it takes it out of you. Yeah. But magnificent.
The funny thing about that film is there's literally nothing funny about watching it. But afterwards, I saw. The funny thing connected to that movie is I saw a Q&A with Matthew Holness at Cameo. I saw a screening at the Q&A, and Matthew Holness said that his next film that he's working on is even darker and more twisted than that film. So I don't even know I'm not sure I want to. I mean, that's a weird insight into Matthew Holness's mind.
Yeah. He's pushing my boundaries, what you're saying sometimes.
Although I'm also excited, you know. If
yes, yeah, excited, curious, but also terrified. Okay, so we're now we move on to the second last film that we're talking about. My personal number one, number two on Storm's list, number three on Ron's list. It's Mandy. Which I just loved this film. I was really looking forward to this film. It premiered at Sundance, like way back at the start of 2018. And then there was like nothing. It got a bunch of really good reviews, and then there was nothing on it until a trailer dropped for it in about June. And I had seen the director, I can never remember. It's Panos Cosmatos is his name. I saw his film Beyond the Black Rainbow, which is one of the weirdest films, one of the most surreal films you're likely to see. Has like absolutely no plot. This film is actually for people who have not seen Mandy is completely mental, but actually has more narrative logic to it than Beyond the Black Rainbow does. Just a completely mental film.
Black Rainbow, whereas Mandy is an homage to sort of 70s aesthetic, Black Rainbow did the same thing for sort of 80s new wave and whatnot, yeah?
Yeah, kind of. But I mean, there was just less, I mean, there's not really a plot to that movie. Right. Just things happen. You know, like, in the kind of way that, you know, there's just certain films that just things happen in them. And you're not quite sure that you have to kind of parse the logic of it. It's maybe not quite as mental as something like Inland Empire, but it's kind of up there with that kind of thing. Of just like, yeah, there's events. You know, the movie kind of starts and it finishes. It doesn't have like a beginning, middle, and end. You know, it's one of those kind of movies. Yeah. But Mandy, as mental as it is, does have kind of some plot, some narrative. But I just love the imagery of the I love the imagery of the movie. I love the soundtrack of the movie from Johan Johansson.
Everything works so well together.
Yeah, just the scene with Nicolas Cage's performance in it, I think, is just amazing. And I think for me, Nicolas Cage drinking vodka, screaming in the bathroom, is one of the absolute scenes. Like, just
did you see Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call?
What?
The Werner Herzog film, Port of Call. It was the Bad Lieutenant.
Bad Lieutenant.
It was like that. It was just, I mean, he's just so fun to watch. When you just give him a line of coke and just tell him to go nuts. I mean, and I don't, this is one of those films where it was like, you be you, man, just fucking go nuts.
Yeah, I feel like it was the pinnacle of, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this have seen the YouTube clip of Nicolas Cage losing his shit in every film he's ever been in. And nobody loses shit like Nicolas Cage, but he really outdid himself in this movie.
It is very much peak Cage.
It was a pleasure to watch, and I couldn't help but I just giggled at so many scenes when he was just like laughing manically at nothing. Yeah. And I joined in the trip with him. You want to.
Yeah. I have friends that are put off by the fact that I hate Nicolas Cage. Like, I can't act for shit. But I mean, even if you hate Nicolas Cage, just you can have fun hating him on this film.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever you love or hate about that guy, it's all there.
I think so. I have to say that, you know, like, because Nicolas Cage's performance is so big and it takes up so much in the movie, it's obviously the thing people talk about. But obviously, a performance that big needs like kind of good counterfoils. And I think it's, you know, if you know, you need to kind of watch the movie closely, but performance actually by Andrea Riseborough is actually really good, and it's a kind of perfect counterfoil. And then those opening scenes are actually really quite touching and melancholic. And I think, like, even though her character is not necessarily given a lot to do, her performance really imbues that character with something.
Agreed.
Yeah, and even just the way the actress looks as well. Yeah. Just the shots where they really just focus on her face and not much else, and you're just looking at her intensely, as you're meant to do. But it really does draw you into the story. And I think that says a lot, that she wasn't really doing anything and yet you were being pulled in.
Oh God, and the acid trip scene.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. So well done.
Yeah. That scene is something to behold. And then the whole kind of, you know, the final sequence, it gets to the temple and the whole, you know, and the thing with the fighting with the flaming axe and
characters that were like some kind of weird guar kind of
some weird metal video.
It's so fantastic, and I love that you don't really know their backstory, but they're just sort of summoned, and there's that weird conversation with about Nicolas Cage's character with his vet friend, he's getting weapons from. He's telling them, like, oh yeah, there's these crazy bikers that took a bunch of acid and lost their minds and sort of became these creatures, and it was just so good. Everything about it was just so much fun.
And it's blurry as well. You don't quite know if it is a supernatural element, if they are creatures, or if it's just a drugged up trip.
If Nicolas Cage is tripping
on. You don't care.
Yeah, you don't know if they're like a kind of supernatural, because I mean, I think they're also kind of designed in that way of they've got a kind of like, they're like a cross between, if you crossed like a Cenobite with a Hell's Angel, that is what that's what that gang is.
And visually, it's like some 70s prog rock album come to life, you know, or some sort of like airbrush painting on some crazy van that you just saw. It's just like every shot of that, I would want a poster of, put on my wall. It's so good.
Absolutely. And I do also want to give a special mention to the Cheddar Goblin, which is the greatest. I would say the greatest fake commercial in a movie. And the Cheddar Goblin's become so culty already. It's got like its own Twitter handle, you know, people, it's taken off. So funny. I loved everything about this movie, and it ended up becoming my movie of the year.
I think that might have like vied with my number one had it not been that. It is a total horror film, but it was such an unconventional horror film, which doesn't diminish its value at all. But it's we'll get to our number one and why. It was hard. That was a really difficult decision. I mean, if it wasn't for the number, what a great year, 2018, for it to have the three contenders were just so fantastic that I really wrestled with what was my favorite of the three.
Yeah, I mean, again, not to say what our number one is, but I think it only won for me because it was much more of a traditional horror film than Mandy.
Mm. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. So we'll do that now. This is the very last film we'll be talking about. It is Hereditary. Ronan Storm's number one, my number two. All three of us loved it. It just pipped by Mandy for me, but an amazing film. I'll let you guys talk about it first, as it was number one on both your lists.
I think I saw it on opening night, and I haven't stopped thinking about that film since. Like I think about it at least once a day. It got under my skin on such a profound level. It's just it's probably my all-time favorite horror film.
I'm with you. I'm right there with you, as you know. It never stops being a movie that my head will come back to. And quite often when I'm watching other horror films since I've seen Hereditary, I find myself going, but you know, this is no Hereditary. So it's kind of set the bar so high.
Set the standard. for
the I hadn't
actually been terrified by, I mean, I thought, you know, I'm pushing 50, so the idea that I can actually be scared by a horror film at this point in my life, I thought those days were past, and I was terrified. Like the last 15 minutes of Hereditary, I was completely terrified and still think about them all the time. It really did some damage.
Yeah, that's it. It does damage. And I think I can see why people wouldn't like that. But of course, if you love horror, I think in some weird little twisted way, you kind of like damaging your mind a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it comes back to a lot of things we have been talking about. Of like, it is a horror movie that very much deals in character. It's a horror movie that has psychological depth. It's a horror movie that deals with family dynamics and the shifting relationships. You know, it's got all those elements going on. And also, I think one of the chief pleasures for me was it was just a surprising movie of like it with all the marketing and with the trailers and everything, it deliberately wrong foots you. You think you know what the movie is about. You think you know what the focus of the movie is going to be, and it's not that.
Exactly.
So many trailers totally spoil a movie. So that was one of the
from the opening shot, I think when it goes into the dollhouse, you're sort of I can see where it's just so deftly handled. It keeps on throwing you sort of off track, and when it's over, it's really not that unconventional. It's just so masterfully made that it feels like, wow, it just slaps you upside your head with all these sort of questions of trust and family and grief, and it's just so fucking well done. And Toni Collette's performance is just, man, she really deserves recognition for that, because that's one of the.
And can we just talk about how well Toni Collette does horror? I mean, obviously her big break was Sixth Sense, and
that's true.
Seeing how she's developed in terms of being a horror actress was so exciting. And I think it only gets better as Toni Collette gets older and her face gets more interesting as well. Yeah. And the expression...
Her reactions to things in this movie were amazing.
Yeah, her expressions on her face were just... I mean, oh my God, you're right there with her.
All the scenes between her and her son were just so disturbing.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially the one where she wakes him up after the nightmare, and I won't.
No, don't worry.
that is definitely one of the. I mean, I was just on the edge of my seat, like just the there was just a feeling in the pit of my stomach, like an uneasy feeling in the pit of my stomach that I don't often get, because I wrote like you guys, like probably a lot of people listening to this podcast. I watched so many horror movies that for a horror movie to like properly get under my skin. It takes a bit. That scene was just, it just twisted your guts and, really creeped under your skin.
Throughout the entire movie, I kept thinking of the line from the Philip Larkin poem, "They fuck you up, your mom and dad, they don't know you that way."
Yeah.
And that was where, I'm sure for me and for many people watching this movie, a lot of the terror comes from, because it really does show you the worst possible scenario in terms of a parent-child relationship.
Generations.
Yeah, over generations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the way Toni Collette was fucked up as a child, and then she is fucking her own children up. And yeah, I mean, there's so many standout scenes with Toni Collette. I mean, the scene where she like totally flips out in the kind of the dinner scene. The scenes towards the end. This is the thing, actually. Some people are very split on the kind of that end sequence. Some people feel like it moved the movie in a slightly silly, kind of over the top direction. But I actually enjoyed it. I thought it worked. I don't know, obviously it really worked for you, Ron, What about you, Storm? You felt it worked? Or?
You bring that scene up because when I saw it in the cinema, when that scene started, people in the theater started laughing.
Mm.
I found myself getting really angry at the laughing because I was so involved in that scene and I was terrified. And I think it worked perfectly. And I couldn't figure out if the audience were laughing because they were so afraid that they were uncomfortable or if they just thought it was kind of hokey. But I have definitely heard that criticism of it, that it went in the wrong direction in the last 15 minutes. But I could not disagree more. I think it went exactly where it needed to go and just gave you a full blast of terror.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it was verging on ridiculous. And I think that's what made it so effective. Mm. It was, I don't know how, for me, a lot of intense horror comes from a place where it's almost so fucking terrifying that it's almost, it makes you want to laugh. Or just sort of the nude smiling hippies in the background that you can barely see in the dark. they're just like, what the fuck? It's just there was so many what the fuck moments in that last 20 minutes. It was just, oh god. And then the whole treehouse and even that the blue light, which looked really hokey, which kind of followed through when something horrible was about to happen. If you remember those, it's a recurring theme throughout the film. And that, you know, it was obviously an incredibly low budget, but it worked for me for whatever reason.
Yeah.
It's just, if they'd put more effort into it, or not more effort, I don't know what kind of we're looking for, more production value into that, it wouldn't have worked as well. It was just a perfect confluence of ideas, I think.
Even the creepy little twitchy noise that the little girl made. Exactly. It could have not worked so easily. Yeah. And yeah, it did. And I've never heard that particular noise come from, you know, creepy child in a horror film, of which there are many. She was really a very original.
What was her name? Molly Shapiro, man. She was like, I don't think any other actress could have played that part because she was just perfect.
I can only but agree. And I enjoyed the ending. I really felt the ending was kind of necessary as well. I think that it was clearly culminating to something. There was a kind of pressure cooker effect of the movie, like bubbling through, and it had to pop at some point. It had to explode at some point. And I felt like The Wicker Man is a movie I mentioned earlier on as well, and again there was that kind of Wicker Man element of like breadcrumbs leading to something terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So it made sense to me because I thought about it in kind of those terms of like it being similar to the Wicker Man in that particular regard. Well, that's it. We've done it. We have surveyed the best horror films of 2018. According to the three of us, I'm sure plenty of you will agree with a bunch of our choices. I've seen a lot of our choices on other top 10 lists. I'm sure a bunch of you will disagree with a bunch of our choices. But you can just tell us all about it on Twitter, on Facebook, below the line on the website. And remember, you can check out this episode on the website, but you can also check it out on iTunes and Stitcher, where it would be much appreciated if you rate, review, and subscribe to New Horror Express. If you could go over there and give us the good old 5 stars, that would be just brilliant. But that's all. And remember to tune into the next episode where I'm talking to Sinister Horror Company founders and horror novelists themselves, Justin Parks and Daniel Mark Chant.